You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, Christ is Risen. Today is the middle of Easter week, April 27th, 2022. I have one announcement. I'm not going to get into too much detail here, but through the effort of a few friends of mine, my wife slash agent as well, I'm going to be putting out some merchandise relatively shortly. There's so many things. There's a market for a lot of this stuff. These are Nicholas or Kodrianu or nationalism in general, Putin stuff, whatever it is. There's people who want this and very few people who are offering it, and certainly not offering it in a way that Americans have any interest in. And that's going to be coming soon. I'll give you more announcements there as this develops. And as always, I want to thank my donors and friends, theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com is the blog that Sven Longsang set up for me, and that's where you can do the donations. And my website as well has the blue Support the Orthodox Medievalist here, which has a double eagle on it. There's Patreon, there's Coinbase, I have quite a bit of ways to donate, and I do thank everyone who's even considered it. But with Patreon as well as the merchandising coming up, hopefully we can continue to raise some money to keep us functioning. I want to talk about a few things today. I don't normally, there are a few exceptions to this, but I don't deal with kind of common issues. Let other people do that. The Elon Musk stuff, I really don't care. What happens with Johnny Depp is not all that interesting to me. And I don't think people who tune into this series here care that much either, except to make fun of it. Even the war in Ukraine, which never was much of a war, as I knew as soon as I got back from my honeymoon, started going through the material. But let me give a summation here. I'm not even talking about the causes or even the effects, but I want to give a summation why this had to have been something promoted by NATO in the U.S., especially, not any ruling class people in Ukraine. Of course, Ukraine is a colony. So it's something along the lines of a colonial possession doing the dirty work of its owner. But why they never had a chance? Why this was so ridiculous? Why the propaganda from the absurd media just doesn't, it can't hold even the slightest. It can't go up against even the slightest criticism, the slightest logical critique of it. And I have a few just basic reasons that people need to consider. Ukraine has never had a unified chain of command. They've never promoted people based on merit. Especially over the last few years, they've promoted people based on ideological subservience. The same thing goes for the American military, too. It's a deadly flaw. When you promote people based on ideology rather than ability, you're asking for trouble. And this is exactly what's been happening in Ukraine. You can't have pro-Russian people wearing stars in that country. If there's one overarching cause for the disintegration of Ukraine, it would be that, militarily speaking. But almost as important is the fact that they don't have money. They don't have a functional economy. They don't have the resources for any kind of war of attrition. This is why the nuclear and the poison gas options were always there. they were always present. Because a conventional war is absurd from the Ukrainian point of view. If it were a prosperous place, something like South Korea, it would be a different story. But it's not. It's a backwater. No different than Georgia in 2008. Nothing that the Ukrainian elites, that is, those connected with NATO, anything they've wanted, they have not achieved. Except for public humiliation. Anything that they've sought in seeking to destroy Novorossiya or humiliate Russia, none of that has ever come to pass. And the only reason it ever was attempted was that NATO pushed them into it. They never had much fuel. This is more of a technical thing. People don't realize any kind of mechanized unit, especially when you have a lot of them, fuel is, the fuel demands are immense. You don't have enough oil and gas to heat your home in Kiev, then you're not going to have anything to put in the mechanized units that are necessary to win any kind of a war today, any kind of conventional war today. They didn't have Western direct military support from the very beginning. Within 2 or 3 days, NATO had pulled back, saying we're not going to get involved in this. And once the route was clear enough, even, you know, the allies of this regime were pulling away. You have a country, of course, that's extremely divided. There are way too many Russians there. There are way too many people who know exactly what they would be fighting for. They knew, of course, that just like in 2014, the Ukrainian army is going to just disintegrate. They're not dying for New Khazaria or anything like that. They will, however, die for something like Novorossiya, or to be as well off as Crimea. And, of course, that's another reason, of course, that Crimea is just across the river. And it's in excellent shape, primarily because it joined Russia and uses a ruble and has all of these markets open to it that actually need Crimean materials. But that deep division, and Crimea is one of these things, deep divisions within the population itself, the tremendous divisions even among nationalists, such as they are, whether they be real or not. You have the largest church in Ukraine is, of course, the Russian church. You can't win an all-out war, certainly not a war of attrition, without some basic unity, and that didn't exist. And it's proven by the fact that the Ukrainian government had to ban all Russian newspapers, all Russian reporters, any professor or anything else that was too pro-Moscow was purged, and some of them are rotting in prison right now. Just from that alone, they never had any chance. No different than Georgia in 2008. You don't have an industrialized economy there like you used to have. You can't prosecute a war, even a fairly brief one, without the industry to support it. You can't win a war based entirely on aid from abroad, especially aid that often is misused with people who are poorly trained. And as you have heard this, you've heard me say this before, but in order for a military to function under any circumstances, you have to have weaponry and ammunition and training methods and coordination that's reciprocal. You can't have one unit using one rifle, another unit using another, and expect to have spare parts or anything breaks down. All this Western assistance was totally inappropriate for the old Soviet model stuff that the Ukrainian military is used to using. And they really don't have the money to upgrade. And there's going to be a point where the banks are just sick and tired of pouring tens of billions into a country that never seems to use it right, that has no non-corrupt element in government, and has no hope so long as this regime is in power. They're going to get tired of just throwing money at them. And there's too many there that simply distrust Western liberalism. There's no distinction in the Slavic mind today between liberalism on the one hand and Western elites on the other. The Western military is the armed variation of some version of liberalism. This is just another variation of the opium wars in China. This is what free trade really means. You have way too many, including Ukrainian nationals, who are actual Ukrainian nationalists. You buy my book with that title, Ukrainian Nationalism, you'll see there's an army of them who want nothing to do with this regime. They know exactly what they're fighting for. They're not going to fight for it. The divisions, even there, are too fatal. And the West is no better off. They are drowning in debt. They don't have the political foundation to prosecute a war, except maybe in Panama. And even there, you know, in places like Grenada, some of you have read my Patreon article on this, where there were tremendous American casualties in Grenada against a handful of people. But Russia has proven itself militarily, both in Syria and in Georgia. The U.S. has not proved itself militarily anywhere, not since Iwo Jima. And even there, they had to use poison gas, which I've discussed at some length, yellow phosphorus. That's what they pumped into the caves to drive the already emaciated Japanese out. You know, the non-commensurability of weaponry and ammunition and spare parts, that also has to go with proper training. These guys got very rapid training on the new stuff that the U.S. and the Germans were bringing in. Very quickly. And there weren't enough advisors. So you have one unit with some American training, another unit that had zero, and they had no idea how to communicate. They had different foundations. And then when you have a militia-based, you know, some of these so-called nationalist militias, these groups that combined in an election get no more than 2% of the vote combined. Clearly they have no even with Western subsidies, they don't have a foundation. They don't have a support base in the country. Even though, you know, there's legitimate groups that have an excellent agenda. But some of them act on their own. Some of them are integrated within different aspects of the armed forces, including border patrol and everything else. And some do whatever they please. The policy of giving weapons to just anybody early on clearly came from Washington. Didn't make any sense militarily and certainly not diplomatically, because in that case, it means there is no such thing as a civilian. That's why it's such a disastrous policy. You know, someone gets killed not wearing a uniform. Well, we have no idea why this person was killed, despite the fact that Russia has been extremely careful, too careful, in avoiding civilian casualty. As I've said 100 times, they could have wiped the place out in a week. Obviously, you've known from the very beginning that air superiority was never going to be gained by the Ukrainians. Most of that air force was destroyed on the ground. Most of it's out of date. Most of the pilot training is extremely poor. It's a few hours compared to what, you know, the incredibly advanced Russian Air Force has at its disposal. The very fact that you needed this level of media manipulation shows that they simply didn't have a case. You don't ban your opposition if you're in a position of strength. I don't know how many times I've said that. It obviously is from a position of weakness. So just to name a handful. I mean, of course, there's a lot of others. You know, I've brought up desertion. I think I'm pretty much the only one, at least in English, that's bringing up desertion as a crisis, both in the American military abroad and the Ukrainian military in this case. Desertion was a huge problem in the war in 2014 against Novorossiya. This is not being covered. It's not even being covered by the Russian press. I have the feeling when everything is over officially, we're going to go over this and see exactly. You know, it's not considered really a casualty. I suppose it'd be something like missing in action, but there is no desertion rate put in any casualty figures. That's probably a good thing. Again, no one's fighting for this regime, and certainly not the one in Ukraine, was, you know, overseeing a fourth world society. So when it comes down to it, those are your basic reasons that this thing was a evil thing from the beginning. That the U.S. continues to pour weapons in, appropriate or not. You know, the idea seems to be to keep this war going as long as possible. Ukraine can't win. It can't win for all the reasons I just said. I'm sure there's 1,000 more. But this whole thing was a sick joke played on Ukraine. It's already a losing population, both in terms of out-migration as well as family policy. starting in 2004, really in 2004, the so-called Orange Revolution, and then its fruition in 2014, you know, they have power a few hours a day in most places. Hospitals are not operating. They're charging for every little thing because there's no, you know, public schools are charging. They're shutting them down all over the place. This has been going on for a decade now almost. It's a disaster where they simply don't have the resources for their own population, let alone to build these huge naval bases that the West is demanding they do. You realize how ridiculously expensive a navy is and how absurd if you don't even have a fuel supply. There is nothing left now. This is totally the result of the fall of the Soviet Union and Western and Judaic, the Khazar meddling, and the creation of New Khazaria near Odessa, which, thank God, now is no longer a possibility either, which is one of the reasons that you have strong Jewish support for the Ukrainian cause, and one of the reasons that the Israeli state, while never supporting Russia, has not been vociferous concerning Ukraine either. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. So, otherwise, you know, on Thursdays with Sven, I deal with the economic and diplomatic ramifications of everything. But it's getting to the point now where it's starting to bore me. I've been saying these same things over and over and over again since at least 2004, as far as the Ukrainian economy was concerned. People like Kuchma had a handle on things. These men were far from like Yanukovych. But at least they weren't going to be absolutely subservient to foreign capital. You know, there was a time where, and this is unfortunately near the end of Yanukovych's reign, where there was a literal selling of parts of Western Ukraine and a few sections of Eastern Ukraine to major Western oil firms. Now, what I mean here is not that they were given permission to use land. They were given ownership of it, where Ukrainian laws didn't even apply. Well, I've written about this some years ago. It's one of the things that created this kind of nationalist contempt for him, despite him, you know, doing a lot of positive things. But literally selling, you know, ExxonMobil had full control over the entire country's water system because Ukraine simply doesn't have the resource. It has the resources for nothing that a modern state has to do, let alone to prosecute a war like this. It's a, and the only one who wins, of course, is the regime. Because if there's one country that doesn't trust Western liberalism, it's Ukrainians. Now, that being said, I want to talk about something that you may find obscure. But that's kind of what I do here. I talk about things that no one else can, no one else wants to, no one else has the ability, and not just an obscure area for its own sake. But understand why you study this in the first place. And I want to talk in brief here about the gathering of the Russian land and why it's so important today. It's always, these historical lessons are always important. Gathering of the Russian land is a process. If you've read my Third Rome, it's my first book I ever wrote, a little cringy today. I was 29 when I wrote it, something like that. It's one of the most earth-shattering developments in it actually, not just Russian history, it created today what we know as Russia. And the gathering simply refers to the old appanages, independent cities, independent regions being brought together. They all spoke the same language. They all had the same religion. Therefore, they should have been under one monarch. And it took a very long time to make that happen. And I bring it up, and I brought it up before, because this is how nations are built. An ethnic group doesn't just fall from the sky. An ethnic group develops inner loyalty because of these struggles, depending on whether it be topography or economy or whatever. And why Russia took the form it did, why it took the more or less, compared to what it was, centralized royalist form it did. And I want to talk about someone I don't think I've mentioned in detail before, and that's the Grand Duke Basil III, who died in 1533. When I was in grad school, one of my Russia professors, Anne Klimola, did agree with me. I said, this man is not talked about very much, and yet he is absolutely essential in building what we today know as Russia. And there's a few things going on here. I don't bring this up for no reason. This is how states were built in the same way that Putin rebuilt in 2000, 2006, whenever that was, roughly speaking. This is where nations come from. This is where states come from. And Russia was lucky in this respect, and that there was a clear trajectory right up until the 18th century that built an empire, an Orthodox empire, the last Christian empire, out of a mess of warring principality. With the tragedy that they all spoke the same language and all had the same religion. These were the same people. The political biases came from their own self-interest of the oligarchy rather than, and it was from here that I built the notion that, historically speaking, any political system has one of two tendencies, and they're incommensurable. That is towards dispersal, which means local strongmen, oligarchy, chaos, destruction, or royalism, and that could be any conception to the common good. Platonism, Hegelianism, this is a monarch, a military government, a government that springs from the ethnic group, not from local self-interest. Republics, as we normally define the term, coming from the banking system of North Italy in the Renaissance, is the former. What a republic is at its root, and you see this in Florence and Venice and, you know, in Renaissance Italy, where this stuff really came into its own, is once the monarchy is destroyed, the killing of the king ritual, the sons, and that's a metaphor, sons, the strongmen of the area, want to take the pieces of the country that they think they deserve. Monarchs simply are too powerful. Their political power in their mind is not commensurate with their wealth, what they think their abilities are. Unfortunately, what they realize is that their authority, not their power, but their authority, comes from the monarch. So they find themselves in a bad situation. So they have to have a myth, and that myth has something to do with freedom. But it's a myth in the sense that people who already rule it possess everything you need to lead a free, rational lifestyle, and most people do not. It's how to pick apart. It's simply a council of wealthy men, which is what republicanism is. And this is something that Daniel Shays, in the beginning of the American, right after the American Revolution, began to realize. This is something that Savonarola realized in the Italian Renaissance. I've talked about him at great length. The opposite, of course, is monarchy in one form or another. I've talked about this, whether it be in Germany, whether in Russia, South Korea, Indonesia. Those are the two very general options that any society has. Basil III, no, Vasily III, Ivanovich, isn't talked about very much because he is shoved between two incredible rulers, Ivan the Great, or Ivan III, which is why it's Basil Ivanovich, and then his son, Ivan IV, or Ivan the Terrible. Russia was very lucky for one good reason, that you had three rulers who had very long reigns. That's very important, especially prior to there being stable institutions. Basil the Great ruled for decades. Ivan III ruled for more than 40 years. Ivan the Terrible, almost 60. It's absolutely extraordinary, and that provides a certain level of continuity and stability that a relatively new ethnos needs to develop. So we're talking about from the middle of the 15th century to the end of the 16th. Basil lives from 1473 to 1533. So it will be commensurate with the Renaissance in North Italy. And it moves in the exact opposite direction that the republican systems move in. You had republics on Russian soil, especially Novgorod and Pskov, that became very unpopular for the reasons that you could probably figure out. Poland went in the other direction. Poland became an explicit oligarchy. They didn't have a centralized military. Everything was at the noble level. The crown was completely powerless, generally speaking. And any time, even if it was in their interest, any time the crown became too powerful, usually through a victory in war, his own nobles would do everything they can to strip him of any glory, of any benefit from that, including making deals with their own enemies to maintain their positions. That's why oligarchy is so inherently evil. It enshrines the will to power, whether it be explicit or not. That's what they consider freedom to be. Monarchy concerns the common good. This is why, and unfortunately, the process of making certain that oligarchy doesn't develop can be very bloody. Because there is nothing that one of these nobles, one of these independent-minded oligarchs, nothing that they won't do to maintain their property. And they don't care what they have to do. They'll become traitors, they'll become Catholics, they'll become anything in order to maintain their power. Under Ivan III, what we call at the time the Grand Duchy of Moscow, grew tremendously. All of the northwest, the great Novgorod, Tver, Yaroslav, Vyatka, these huge, fairly well-off areas all became part of what today we call the Russian state. And it began to grow militarily, economically, politically, such that European and Asian powers began to take notice. And because they didn't understand the, you know, Russian Orthodox idea coming both from Bulgaria and Byzantium, they saw it as a hostile threat to them. Basil III comes from the Byzantine Empire directly because his mother was the niece of the last emperor of Byzantium. This is why they took the double eagle at this period of time. This is why they rebuilt the Kremlin to imitate, to some extent, the Byzantine state itself, architecturally speaking. And that's where the white stone cathedrals in the Moscow Kremlin developed. To this day, the double eagle is the royal seal of Russia, which, among many, many, many other things, talks about the unity of church and state. Byzantium had fallen. Constantinople had fallen just a few years before Basil III was born. And you can't get any more significant than that. The last sizable Orthodox power, of course, was Russia. And it became the Third Rome. And then when it fell, the Bolshevik Empire, and is now being slowly but surely reborn, there's not going to be a fourth. But even his offspring, Basil's offspring, Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, he finally, at great cost to himself, smashed the oligarchy, led by people like Elena Glinskaya and Novgorod, who actually was a slave owner. This is the extreme of republican systems. And they were willing to join with Poland against their own people. They cared about their position, not about Russia, not about the language or the religion. They would do anything that they could. And if there was any true republic in Russia at the time, it was this state. Ivan the Terrible realized this and finally had to bring that place to heel. It had been brought to heel many times, but that wealth was too much of a temptation. He needed to use sometimes rather extreme physical force to challenge the oligarchy, which means you had men with large, multiple private armies. Again, even there, you didn't have a centralized army. That came a little bit later. Local lords had their own private armies, sometimes navies, and intelligence. And, you know, diplomatic corps, and everything else. These are countries. But because of those two, it's easy to forget about Basil III, who did much of the legwork here. Now, his rule is the very beginning of the 16th century, 1505 to 1533. Again, another lengthy period of time. You have this 30 years that doesn't get talked about really at all, even by medievalists. Russia grew so steadily because you had these three rulers with lengthy, a very stable reign. They were taken very seriously. They were fairly moral people under the circumstances, of course. They were not necessarily Machiavellian. They had the full support of the church and, for the most part, of the workers in the cities. When Ivan moved into Novgorod, he was met with a very happy population, a very angry oligarchy. No one likes oligarchs. And because of that, they have to tell myths about themselves. Monarchs don't really have to do that. Russia could never have become Russia without Novgorod and Tver, let alone eastern Ukraine. These are very wealthy cities, willing to make alliances with Moscow's enemies wherever they go. Pskov, Smolensk, Ryazan, Russia could never have gathered their ethnic people. These were all Russians. It was only the separatist rulers, the oligarchs, that saw themselves politically as different. And if they had to tell a story, they'd tell a story to do it. Unfortunately, a lot of that has not come down to us because Peter the Great found all these local histories from the noble families and burned them. So much of the history we don't know. We have to find from other sources. But all these cities were annexed as possessions of the Moscow state under Basil III. All these rulers had a piece of it, but it usually doesn't happen immediately. You're talking about a lot of very wealthy people, and they did it legally. But sometimes they needed violence because they have their private army. This is why the Moscow Kremlin was so important. He began building fortresses in the south of the country. We see this today, where the oligarchs from North Italy were financing the development of these Turkic tribes to go in and find slaves in the extreme southern part of it, you know, just north of the Caucasus, where, you know, roughly Baku and places north there, through the Black Sea. And the Jewish port of Kaffa in the Black Sea is where most of this was, the money was exchanged, coming directly from Khazaria. These are the symbols of Moscow's victory over these forces. As I mentioned, Basil is the son of Constantinople from the Palaiologue family. Sophia Palaiologos, of course, is her name, married a second time. And that's, again, the niece of the last Byzantine emperor, Constantine XII. 1472, they were wed. And Basil, the ruler here, was a fourth child of this couple. He was literally then a Byzantine by blood and then by culture. That marriage that produced Basil III can't be overestimated. Because not only now you had the ethnic gathering, but now you had what form the state will take. It doesn't come from the so-called Mongol. It comes from Constantinople, to a lesser extent, Bulgaria. Finally, in 1478, Novgorod is fully annexed, but again, they're going to rise again more than once after that. And more extreme methods had to be found. Otherwise, you would have a very wealthy part of Russia giving itself over to her enemy. This has been the crux of Russian history since Russia's come into existence. The Russian Empire has nothing to do with commercial ties. It was the end of these commercial ties. It was about self-protection. This is why Ukraine is so damn important. This is why Ukraine, that Russians are willing to die for. Without these places, Russia simply isn't Russia. You cannot have a Orthodox Slavic population, at least in the eastern part of Ukraine, somehow ruled by enemies of that very same group of people, and then used as a staging area to hit Russia, which is exactly what NATO was doing. But this goes back that far, this concern. Titles were very important at the time. Ivan was called the Grand Duke of all Russia, and Basil ended up, you know, stringing a whole bunch of cities after that. The title was used by the princes before, but not only reflected the new conquests of Ivan, but expressed a claim to all Orthodox Slavic areas. That would include in parts of Poland, that would include what we would call Ukraine today, that would include almost all of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. It's easy to forget that Lithuania had a huge Russian Orthodox population, a huge church, which had a separate church structure, led by the Metropolitan Joseph Soltan, and had its own synodal system and everything else. But once the Poles absorbed the area, they began the process of throwing a lot of them out. And so these Lithuanian princes became they're really the core of the Russian nobility. And because they're serving princes, in other words, they served only to the extent that they held their land and peasantry only to the extent that they served the monarch. And that would be either militarily, to a much lesser extent, diplomatically, or at court as a clerk of some kind. But mostly it was a very dangerous job of defending the giant borders of what is now a huge ethnic conglomerate. Basil III was known for bringing a lot of these Lithuanians, Russian Lithuanians, to Moscow because they were being thrown out. The state is being built only because the ethnic group is being put together. Ivan III's title reflected the idea that Orthodox Slavs are under his control. Because even there, they're talking about Armageddon. They're talking about the fact that now the last Rome exists. This is why the connection with Constantinople was so important. The Third Rome is a simple matter of historical fact because Ivan married into that family. And when Sophia came to Moscow, she came with an army of writers and technicians and books and everything else. They built the new Constantinople right there on in the Seven Hills. Remember, both Old Rome, Constantinople, and Moscow are situated on Seven Hills. And he's one of the people who created this new servant, what we call serving princes, or serving nobles, military men with great responsibility, joining the Moscow service, whether they're native or coming from abroad. End of the 15th, beginning of the 16th century. Now, the way it was before, as the country could fall apart any moment, was the country being divided up into what are called appanages. It's a French term. The way it's used is what it's used is a piece of a country ruled over by a close relative of the monarch. Prior to Ivan and Basil, they're people from different families. Only later were they overthrown, and then now you had governors that were appointed by the center. The Apanish princes were the closest relatives of the Grand Duke, which in and of itself took a long time to pull off. They received certain possessions from either their father or their brother. Then the service princes who had departed from elsewhere, especially Lithuania, and even parts of Poland, parts of what we would call Ukraine today, even farther south than that. You had a mass defection from a lot of these areas because you couldn't be Orthodox within the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, not for very long. And their possessions, the huge tracts of land, were granted them right on the Muscovite-Lithuanian border. Not only against Poland, but also the Crimean Tartars in the south. But because they came from elsewhere, Basil III treated them with a tad bit of distrust. They could not claim the throne, that they were not from the same family. But there was always a departure, a concern for their departure, possibly back to Lithuania or wherever, depending on what deal they were made. And it happened more than once, where a monarch in Central Europe would offer them a fortune to remove themselves from Russia, which is one of the reasons why these three men, Ivan III, Basil III, and Ivan IV, had to take such drastic action when they did and move quickly, which only a monarch can do. These are serious threats that if enough of them did it at the same time, they could wipe Russia off the map. Because militarily and politically speaking, these service nobles were essential, critical, economically as well as politically and diplomatically. One example is Prince Basil Ivanovich Semyachia of Novgorod-Tversky in 1523, who, again, was one of these defectors, summoned to Moscow and eventually thrown in prison. Why? He was a very talented general. He died in prison a year later. But these are the things that have to happen. 1509, peace was finally realized between Russia and Poland, under Sigismund I. People like Semyonich were stipulated under the treaty to come into the Russian service without any retaliation from his former employers. Because Poland and Lithuania began these pogroms against the Orthodox population. You cannot have a country that divided. Lithuania had to purge itself, either of its Catholics or its Orthodox, be able to function as a country. So because of the wealth of Poland, it became the Orthodox who then went to Russia. There were other princes of this line. The Prince of Starodub, for example, said that this Semyonich was in contact with Lithuania. He was a very talented general. He couldn't afford to lose him very quickly. And so an investigation was done, and for the most part, thanks to the Metropolitan Daniel, there was evidence that he was thinking of leaving, despite the fact that he was very talented. He participated in the latest Russo-Lithuanian war, waging a campaign against Kiev, of course, in 1513, which was under Polish control. And then at the same time, he and a few others had to fight the Tartars, Mohammad Ghiri, Starod, capturing several Crimean princes, by the way, in the process. And he did this more than once, not feeling that he was rewarded well enough. There was more whispers against him. He had already been around a long time, and then before he could defect, even if he's wrong, if there's enough evidence to show that it's a possibility, he had to keep it from happening. He became too powerful. And who knows? Some of the records are scanty, but he was, under false pretenses, brought to Moscow and arrested. And it's because of these kind of things. And these are kind of the Machiavellian tactics that the Grand Dukes had to do. If we were ruling the state, we'd be in the same position. So that means that monarchs had more faith in the old Moscow boyar class, which is kind of an untitled aristocracy that had served the Moscow princes for generations and generations, and they all owned lands of their own right, patrimonial. This was a group that were given the plum positions in the small but growing state apparatus. Now, the service nobility was just under them. Their conditions of service were more strict, and the supervision over them equally as strict. Even the children of the boyars were involved in this, and the difference between a boyar and a noble was very, very fluid. There really was no clear concept of a noble until the modern era. The difference is that those from elsewhere, the new service princes, owned estates on the condition of service, which means they were never there. They were on campaign somewhere, always. And most of the time, they didn't come back. This is what took the place of the oligarchs in the separatist states. They owed everything to the sovereign. Their life revolved around service. They had no other claim to land. They had no other claim to anything. But for the most part, this was how the military was organized. I mean, theoretically, the sovereign could take away their estates at any moment, which you couldn't do in Poland, for example. That would be absurd. You couldn't do it in Lithuania. You could only do it in a centralized system like Russia, who had had far more enemies than in these other places, was far larger than all these other places. But that threat was minimal so long as they didn't get the whispers that Basil got about his friends. I've read, depending on who you talk to, there were about 25,000 landowners in the entire country, and each one probably capable of outfitting and training a handful of men, because that was very expensive and it was a substantial investment. They had no choice, not to mention themselves. So combat-ready men at any given moment, maybe 50,000, 60,000 at a maximum. And this is what built Russia. Distrust of outsiders, the obsession with this huge and porous border, and the notion that if you're going to serve the monarch and have the lands that you enjoy, you have to give something back. This is the concept of the common good. You did not have this in Poland. You didn't have this in Italy. In Russia, what you have to pay for, and you pay for it with your labor, and this labor is for the common good. Russia was surrounded then and now by enemies. This is normal situation, having American military, but this is normal for in Russian history. Everywhere you had enemies, and in this case, very large and very well-trained ones. And at any given moment, especially these, what we call the marcher lords, you know, in Germany, called the marcher lords, these service princes on the borders could be enticed away at any moment. And the Polish prince could say something like, "You have to serve the Russian monarch. Isn't that a shame? I'll grant you twice as much land, and you don't have to serve anybody. Train a few men, and that's all I want you to do. You'll have full patrimonial claim to your land." It's really tough for some of these people to resist. The difference is between the mentality of egocentrism and the mentality of the common good, one of the two. And when you're offered something like that, you have a choice to make. There is no middle ground. You didn't have that many large cities in Russia at the time, and the population, irritatingly, was distributed very unevenly. Of course, Moscow was the largest city. As best we could figure, there's roughly 100,000 people that were permanently a part of the city life. Novgorod was second, maybe 25,000, 30,000. That really went up and down depending on the political situation. The center of any city, again, this is a classic Russian idea, the center of any city was a fortress for defense. This is the origin of the Russian city. Then, surrounding it, you had the commercial, the labor, the handicraft segment of the city, the posad, located around it. Of course, townsmen were posadniks, among other things. But even large towns in Russia had a rural core. This is what people don't understand. Cities were filled with fields and vegetable gardens. They functioned like peasants. The fact that they were within city walls didn't change that fact. Vegetable gardens, meadows, fields for grazing cattle in certain places. And the townsmen themselves, the posadniks, were organized in guilds, specializing in whatever form of production they were involved in. And all of these, of course, had to get their license from the governor, who was appointed by the Grand Duke of Moscow. And this was done at a time of incredible stress with a state apparatus in Moscow that was pretty tiny. As you all know, any of you who've read My Third Rome, the bulk of the population, like all over the world, was the peasantry. Let's make something clear. In My Third Rome, one of my favorites that I still cite today, is a section on serfdom. Don't allow the Mensheviks and the regime to tell you what serfdom was, especially back then. No one was owned. That was ridiculous. They served the owner of the land in exchange for the land that they worked on. It was no different than the noble himself. The lord himself had to serve as well, or he loses it. Same thing for the peasant. Peasants were organized in huge communes, which are as old as Russia is. It wasn't, you know, one peasant family against the lord, who was never there anyway. So the entire land area was self-governed. Now, here was a problem, especially during times of warfare. When the population goes down, they're invaded and torched, as the Islamic Tartars did all the time. It was permissible for a peasant to leave his land. It was rarely done, but in judicial code of 1479, you had an opportunity to sign a new contract if you took care of all your obligations with the old one. And it was done at the end of the year, roughly St. George's Day, it's in November. All debts had to be paid, and no outstanding dues were allowed. The problem was is that that served large landowners, because they could make very sweet deals that small landowners couldn't. And this is why. This is why there were regulations placed on peasant movement. Peasants care about ownership of land and keeping the bulk of what they make. That's all they care about. That to them, and being organized communally, that was civic liberty for them. They were much smarter than they're known for. You do have substantial peasant political thought in their actions as well as anything else. They could be very shrewd. They're not the ignorant bumpkins that the urban regime today thinks they are. They were extremely loyal. It was that they distrusted who was ruled over them, but no more so than the Grand Duke himself did. They were royalists, and they saw the Grand Duke as someone who was going to guarantee their position against a noble who was too rapacious. But that condition may not come. I can't wait to be, you know, most nobles were not wealthy. Overwhelmingly, that came under Peter. Most nobles were not wealthy. But that came from a desperate position. Usually, the nobles had it far worse than the peasantry. The peasantry were not out on campaign. They had to grow the food. You know, they worked, half the year. And the only reason they would ever leave if they got a better deal, which meant that now you had huge landowners. And that was going to be stopped. And only someone with the power of the monarch can do that. In the West, it's interpreted as this terrible restraint on peasant liberty, because we all want to be liberal Englishmen. You know, that's what we're all, that's the whole purpose of our world. Of course, that isn't true. You can't have liberty without security and vice versa. Without security, you can't be free, because you don't know what's going to happen. You have to worry about offending people. You have to worry about what may happen tomorrow, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. But with a strong title to land, you can be far freer than the noble who is usually on campaign and maybe is not coming back or becomes a prisoner. So being able to move from one place to another, so long as everything is taken care of, is called the St. George Day rule. And it's because, you know, by that time of the autumn, the season was ending, which was the most labor-intensive part of the year. And they were afraid that if they didn't have that restriction, they'd lose their labor for whatever reason. Someone makes them a better deal elsewhere. They have all these unharvested crops. But only in a place that was organized like Russia did the monarch have the strength to crack down on these actions. How badly that's misinterpreted. Now, under the Petrine regime, it got far worse. But we're not talking about that. Now, this is old Russia. This is a very different story. You don't have serfdom like you had in Poland. It simply didn't exist. You had titles to land, which is all that peasants care about. Their freedom came from that level of security, plus the fact that they were totally self-governing. I said in my third Rome, and I'll say it here again, much of what became the Russian ethnic group and the Russian royal tradition came not just because they're surrounded by enemies and they have all these, you know, what I'm talking about here. This is really what I'm talking about here, is building an ethnic group. This is where nations come from. I mentioned many years ago that the agricultural yield in the northeastern, northwestern parts of Russia was very low, given the nature of the soil and the temperatures. They didn't have a long growing season. It has nothing to do with Russian technology, which is equal to anybody in the world. It's not the issue. It's the terrible place, the terrible soil that they had to work with. So after the sowing was done and everything grew, the peasant collected maybe two or three times more by natural growth, which is much less than in the rest of the world. Now, that changed in the southern part of the country. It's a totally different story. But in the Muscovite section of Great Russia, it became very difficult. But some of that even had to be left over for next year. So the monasteries were commanded, some of the bigger nobles were commanded, to make sure you have plenty of store, because that's a very razor-thin margin here. This system created very few rich people. And this is why the monasteries were so important, because they functioned in a totally different way, and they were closely under state control. This is what produced bishops and very powerful abbots and the political thought of the era. They were extremely significant here and had every reason to be at war with any noble that got too big and got too powerful. This was the origin of the Third Rome idea. And it's not an accident that Philotheus came from Pskov. But one of the reasons you needed a tightly knit royal society was the fact that in these northern areas, you're on the verge of disaster at any given moment. This is why you have the unavoidably low surplus product that comes from the northern soil is what builds compensatory mechanisms, what I call the structures of survival. The ethnic biases, the institutions that history has ethnicities build to become a nation, derives from these problems. Structures of survival. This is how a people survive. Difficult times, foreign occupation, warfare, poverty. This is why they hang together. This is why they die for one another, like you would for your own family if you're normal. The nation is a collection of these structures with people speaking the same language and having the same faith. Especially at the time, but even now, you can't have a nation, and call itself a nation, having two completely different churches. You know, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, Catholic, there's no way. And very rarely can you show that. Lithuania had to purge. Germany, when it unified, had to purge. It's unfortunate, but you can't have a functioning nation when everyone's believing whatever they feel like. This is what built the Russian ethnic way, the ethnos. Basil was at the center of all of this. He, in his 30 years on the throne, began to annex these last surviving autonomous provinces. Pskov in 1510, Lakomansk in 1513, Ryazan in 1521, Novgorod-Tversky in 1522, as I mentioned. Slowly but surely, he took advantage of problems in Poland. There's always chaos in Poland to capture Smolensk. That was a great eastern fortress of Lithuania over a two-year period. And you had a rebel Lithuanian, Prince Mikhail Glinsky, who provided Moscow with artillery and engineers. He is one of the people. You get a purge Orthodox people like him. Well, this is what you get. He's going to go over to Russia and bring his money and men with him. And this is why Smolensk fell. Smolensk was always, it's a fairly wealthy place, right on the border, and has always gone back and forth. the loss of Smolensk was an important injury that the Poland-Lithuanian Commonwealth had to suffer over the course of the Russo-Lithuanian Wars, one of the reasons that they came into existence. And it was only, you know, in Poland you had rapacious oligarchs and a fairly weak monarchy. This is why the Polish situation was always so untenable and always so difficult. And taking advantage of that, Basil is able to take this very significant city and surrendered in 1522. Then, of course, you had the Khanates in the south, the Tartar regions. This was a come from the collapse of the Great Horde. Now, you know my position on the Mongol hordes. Mongol does not refer to an ethnic group at all, in my opinion. But the entire 15th century in the southern part of the country became a time of tremendous crisis for the Horde. Things were changing radically, given Moscow's centralization. They began to fall to pieces. The Khanates of the Crimean, the Kazan, Astrakhan broke off. This is what could have happened to Russia had they not had monarchs like this, had they had not a monarchy at all, and the once powerful state fell to pieces. In 1521, Basil received an emissary from the Iranian Empire, the Safavid Empire, sent by Shah Ismail I, who wanted to create a Russo-Persian alliance against the Ottoman Empire. And this is part of the reason why Basil was equally successful against the Crimean Khanate, too. Yeah, in 1519, he had to buy off the Crimean Khan because he had penetrated all the way to the walls of the Kremlin, Mehmed Gerek. But it didn't last long. He established tremendous Russian influence on the Volga and the tremendous trading potential that at one time was the lifeblood of the Khazar, or the Khazar Khanate, or the Khazar Empire. And it was because the Khazaria was based on oligarchy, too, and that tremendous ethnic divisions that they had. It eventually fell to pieces. And that was prior to the consolidation of Moscow. But things were falling apart with Russia's enemies precisely because of these long reigns of these very talented monarchs. These monarchs were trained from birth to the royal arts, everything from languages to diplomacy to theology. These were not ignorant men. And they knew talent when they saw it. Still, the Horde Khans, the what was left of that former large state, still tried to interfere. But they were going into steep decline. You know, ultimately, it was Ivan III who stopped paying tribute to anybody. This was a declaration of independence. And what was left of the Horde faced off with Ivan in 1480, and they just went home. They were not going to fight each other. They didn't have the confidence to fight what was becoming a tightly centralized Muscovite state. The Battle of the Third, of course, being the heart and soul of this at the time. It's easy to avoid him, but we're not going to do that. This is how states are formed. This is how ethnic groups are formed. They're of ancient origin. There has to be that spark, though. And, of course, in one of the sparks was the church. This so-called feudal opposition to the crown was condemned by every churchman with a handful of exceptions. And it continued on to the reign of Ivan IV. Metropolitan Varlam in 1521 was banished. He just was sent to another monastery because he rejected the fight against the Eponosh prince Semyashich, as I mentioned above. He sent Basilshewski and Voronsky, Ivan, into exile for threatening the stability of the state. This is an extremely delicate time where private armies are everywhere. You cannot risk subversion. This is also the time that Vasian Patrikiev, very important person in the subversion of Russia, if you go back to both my written work and the lecture I did on the so-called non-possessor controversy, which is a myth, you'll see Vasian Patrikiev comes up over and over again, who was a heretic in every sense of the term, and a Judaizer. And sometimes you had churchmen who didn't fully understand this. And he went to a monastery in the north. He was not harmed in any way. But he cannot have this. The church was a mainstay of the crown. And the crown, of course, was a protector of the church. The state produced the form of the law, and the church produced the content of the law. Ivan III died, he had a will. And that will stated that the lands of the crown are solely under the control of the Grand Duke, but he did have brothers, and their estates were fairly large. But certain things, like the Volotsk inheritance, was liquidated in 1513. You had several people dying childless, and they died childless because the monarch didn't allow them to marry. And by law, if there was no immediate successor, that would come under the control of Moscow. These are the things that simply had to be done. And those like Andrei Strelitsky did have sons, but they were very loyal. The writing on the wall was very clear. And there was an almost obsession with justice that you didn't have in rapacious oligarchies. You can't. It's too egocentric for that. Now, I know I'm coming to the end of my hour here. And maybe I'll finish this next week. But you understand what it comes down to is the formation of nations. I talk about this stuff not just because it's interesting history, but because it built an entire country. These structures, these are all structures of survival, created what we now know as a Russian ethnic group. It is normal for the Russians to have a tightly centralized state and having to deal with multiple enemies at once. And the ignorant Westerners, who just, honest to God, believe that the entire point of history is to make everyone liberals. And that is a legitimate thing. This is what everyone wants. We're to go into Iraq and be called heroes. Everyone wants freedom in some very vague sense, when everyone knows what they're talking about. Of course, it isn't true. This is why the U.S. was driven out of Somalia, why they were driven out of Afghanistan, why they're humiliated in Iraq and elsewhere. And now, of course, their colony in Ukraine, unfortunately, has been humiliated for all the reasons I've mentioned. This is why history is so important to making any kind of intelligent decision in this respect. And without this specialized knowledge, it's really tough to understand what's happening. All you have is a few slogans from newspapers. We'll continue talking about Moscow next week, and the building of the ethnic group, among many other things. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time, and Christ is risen indeed. Bye-bye.